We're going to continue with the larger catechism, question 145, and the shorter catechism, question 78. These are questions dealing with the sins forbidden in the ninth commandment. We have been talking about the nature of the ninth commandment and what is required in our verbal dealings and how that affects other aspects of life. The ninth commandment is taking up that common honesty, that bond of common honesty that is required in all societies, whether civil or ecclesiastical. And it's a part of the duty that we owe to one another. And if we fail in this, as we're going to see, we'll talk about it a little bit, but the fact is, any failure in this regard not only is to the harm of others, but it is, in fact, to the harm of ourselves. We're indicting ourselves when we're not honest, when we're not dealing in a forthright manner, but particularly in those matters where there is, in fact, a call to it. That is, we've been asked to tell the truth, and these are people who have not only a right to know, but in some cases, there's even a heightened interest when what we're going to say is going to impact someone else potentially very negatively. So we have to understand that this honesty not only is concerned with what we say, but when we say it and how we say it. We've been talking about the truth and the regard that we ought to have for the truth, but we're going to see here in the sins forbidden that, and we've alluded to this, but it can be unseasonable to tell the truth if it's going to be to someone's hurt unnecessarily, if it's going to lead to a wrong conclusion, even if it's going to in some way damage or injure their reputation. So there are a lot of caveats to how we are to deal with this truth. What we say always has to be the truth, but as I said before, we don't always have to say everything. And that's where some of these sins against the ninth commandment really come into play. We're going to see that we sin and we violate this command very often by saying more than we should. And that there are contexts where we can, in fact, violate and go beyond saying more than we ought. So we're going to look first at the larger catechism and what it says, and then the shorter catechism, which, again, very briefly and pithily, gives us, what is a proper division, proper way of looking at these categories of sins forbidden in the ninth commandment. Question 145, what are the sins forbidden in the ninth commandment? Answer, the sins forbidden in the ninth commandment are all prejudicing the truth and the good name of our neighbors as well as our own, especially in public judicature, giving false evidence, suborning false witnesses, wittingly appearing and pleading for an evil cause, outfacing and overbearing the truth, passing unjust sentence, calling evil good and good evil, rewarding the wicked according to the work of the righteous and the righteous according to the work of the wicked, forgery, concealing the truth, undue silence in a just cause, and holding our peace when iniquity calleth for either a reproof from ourselves or complaint to others. speaking the truth unseasonably or maliciously to a wrong end, or perverting it to a wrong meaning, or in doubtful or equivocal expressions to the prejudice of truth or justice, speaking untruth, lying, slandering, backbiting, detracting, talebearing, whispering, scoffing, reviling, rash, harsh, and partial censuring, misconstructing intentions, words, and actions, flattering, vainglorious boasting, thinking or speaking too highly or too meanly of ourselves or others, denying the gifts and graces of God, aggravating smaller faults, hiding, excusing, or extenuating of sins when called to a free confession, unnecessary discovering of infirmities, raising false rumors, receiving and countenancing evil reports, and stopping our ears against just defense, evil suspicion, envying or grieving at the deserved credit of any, endeavoring or desiring to impair it, rejoicing in their disgrace and infamy, scornful contempt, fond admiration, breach of lawful promises, neglecting such things as are of good report, and practicing or not avoiding ourselves, or not hindering what we can in others, such things as procure an ill name. Shorter Catechism, question 78. What is forbidden in the ninth commandment? Answer, the ninth commandment forbiddeth whatsoever is prejudicial to truth or injurious to our own or our neighbor's good name. I want to point out that I'm going to try to categorize these under that triple division that the Shorter Catechism gives and that we're going to talk about in the first question here. But that said, keep in mind that very often the things that we talk about as general breaches of the truth have and admit of specific applications when it comes to ourselves and others. And so we need sometimes to reach that principle and make proper application. I think we also need to keep in mind that even though we're going to divide this up and talk about how we fail with regard to others and how we fail with regard to ourselves, that relation is a very fluid one. You know, what is objective to us in one situation, we may find ourselves occupying that position subjectively in another situation. And so we need to understand that when we breach these commands, including and especially with regard to this commandment, when we are in fact in violation, what we're doing is we're downgrading. And we are we're removing what is supposed to be this common bond of honesty in society. We're casting everything into confusion and contempt. And the net effect is that when we break this barrier with regard to others, we're not simply harming them, we're harming ourselves. And likewise, when we break this barrier and make it okay with respect to ourselves, we are, in fact, normalizing this behavior in a broader society. So, although we're going to make some specific applications, we're going to point to some things, remember that the whole gist of this commandment is that civil honesty, whether in secular or ecclesial society, our civil honesty only works as well as everyone abides by it. When anyone lets down this hedge, they're letting it down not only for themselves, but for everybody in the society they hold. This idea that people have that they're only harming themselves when they cross these lines is absolutely false and needs to be rebuked again and again. You're not simply harming only yourself. You're setting precedents, you're creating patterns of behavior, and you are, in fact, holding forth as an example to others what you view as a normal and acceptable lowering of this standard of common honesty. So the first question, and this really is aimed at the Shorter Catechism, what ought we to understand the sins forbidden in this command? Now, the answer is that this command forbids anything prejudicial first against the truth itself. Look at 1 Samuel 17:28.
And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, Why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle.
Yeah, when we do anything that is prejudicial to the truth, we're in violation of the ninth commandment. And that should key us in to something that maybe you haven't thought about and maybe I haven't pointed out enough with regard to this commandment, but this commandment is telling us that the truth is important enough to warrant a hedge by having its own commandment in the Ten Commandments. This idea of truth is sacred. This idea of truth is sacrosanct. We shouldn't take it lightly. We shouldn't be attempting to somehow besmirch the truth. So anything prejudicial to the truth itself is striking against this command. Again, second, anything which is against or prejudicial to our neighbor's good name. 2 Samuel 16:3.
2 Samuel 16:3. And the king said, "And where is thy master's son?" And Ziba said unto the king, "Behold, he abideth at Jerusalem, where he said, Today shall the house of Israel restore me the kingdom of my father."
The third is that the commandment forbids anything prejudicial against our own good name. 2 Samuel 1:9, 10, 15, and 16.
2 Samuel 1:9-10. He said unto me again, "Stand, I pray thee, upon me, and slay me, for anguish has come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me." So I stood upon him and slew him, because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head, and the bracelet that was on his arm, and have brought them hither unto my lord. 15 and 16. And David called one of the young men, and said, "Go near, and fall upon him." And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, "Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed."
Ultimately, what we can take away from this division is that this command respects the keeping of the truth objectively, as it's the truth itself, relatively, as in fact it exists between one another, and subjectively, as in fact it impacts and shapes who we are. That's how important the truth is. It is, in fact, of such a nature that it is possessed not only of an objective reality, but it exists both within you and in all of your relations. So that there's nothing that you can think or do with respect to God or man wherein this commandment doesn't have some bearing. We're going to be talking about it primarily in terms of our duty to man. But many of these things that we're going to be talking about, if we were to apply them to the first table of the law and look at the impact that it would have, if we understand that the first table of the law is dealing with not only this truth objectively, but subjectively and relationally in terms of spiritual things, we would understand why it is so very, very important that we honor what Scripture is teaching us, and things like the regulative principle when it comes to matters of worship and government in the church. The truth is that important. The second question then we need to ask is, wherein do we show ourselves contrary or prejudicial to the truth? This is really the question where I want to spend the most time, is talking about the truth objectively, and I think that most of these things that are talked about in the confession or in the catechisms can be examined most easily from an objective point of view. I'm not going to make every possible application. We would be here for a long, long time, as we would with all of the commandments. But the larger catechism gives us some very, very specific directions with regard to these three ideas of truth: the objective truth, the relational truth, and truth subjectively considered. So objectively, we can say this: we act in a way prejudicial to the truth when in public judicatories, whether they're civil or ecclesiastical, we hinder the administration of justice. And we can do this in a number of ways and acting a number of parts. First, as a judge. If you're a judge in any kind of a case, particularly when we're talking about judicatories, we're talking about courts, we're talking about usually courts that have some power and authority of review and possibly censure. As a judge, first of all, we violate this commandment if we have respect to persons, especially when there's some kind of monetary consideration that leads to that. Look at Leviticus 19:15.
Leviticus 19, verse 15. Ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. Thou shalt not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness shalt thou judge thy neighbor.
Yeah, the fact is that monetary considerations or any other kind of considerations other than the truth, if you're a judge in any kind of case, but especially when you're dealing in a judicatory, to have consideration for anything else is going to make you, in fact, view one person with special regard rather than just the truth, is a violation of this commandment. Second way that as a judge in a case you may find yourself acting in a way prejudicial to the truth is when you fail to render justice, because when you fail to render justice as a judge, injustice is made to appear a common thing, which is complained about if we look at Habakkuk 1:4.
Therefore the law is slack, and judgment doth never go forth. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceedeth.
It's the purpose of being in a position of judge to make judgments. And now, I know we're talking formally right now about judicatures, because the catechism brings it up, but remember, you may not always, or you may never be, in a position to sit in judgment formally in a judicature. But these principles all do apply throughout the rest of your life. You're going to make, and you must make, judgment calls throughout your life. And if you do it with respect to something else, or if you fail to do it when it's called for, you're violating this commandment. A third way is by passing of unjust sentences, whereby the righteous are condemned and the wicked are justified. Look at Proverbs 17:15.
Proverbs 17:15, he that justifieth the wicked, and he that condemneth the just, even they both are abominations to the Lord.
Yeah, and that, this is especially a case when it's the prejudice of more than just the name, someone's name, when there's something more involved. You know, your reputation is bad enough to have that sullied. But when not only your reputation is going to be sullied, but you're going to be violated in some other way, that's just an aggravation. Look at 1 Kings 21:9-14.
1 Kings 21:9-14. And she wrote in the letter, saying, proclaim fast, and set Naboth on high among the people, and set two men, sons of Belial, before him, to bear witness against him, saying, thou didst blaspheme God and the king, and then carry him out and stone him, that he may die. And the men of his city, even the elders and the nobles who were the inhabitants in his city, did as Jezebel had sent unto them, and as it was written in the letters which she had sent unto them. They proclaimed a fast, and set Naboth on high among the people. And there came in two men, children of Belial, and sat before him. And the men of Belial witnessed against him, even against Naboth, in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth did blaspheme God and the king. Then they carried him forth out of the city, and stoned him with stones.
Yeah, this is a result of condemning the righteous and justifying the wicked. The job of judging requires strict adherence to the truth. It shouldn't be swayed by all kinds of other considerations. And again, it's entirely undermined if at the end of all of the process, the end result is somehow righteousness or truth is being condemned and a lie is being justified. You've entirely perverted the whole process. You violated this commandment. Right. Fourth, by rewarding the wicked as if they are righteous, or the righteous as if they are wicked. Look at Isaiah 5:23.
Isaiah 5:23, which justify the wicked for reward and take away the righteousness of the righteous from him.
Yeah, this idea of rewarding the wicked as if they're righteous. Not only is there a perversion of the truth, but there is, in fact, in that kind of behavior. And I want you to think, because most people who hear this are not going to be in a position of judging in a judicature. But most people are in matters of business or family, just general social settings, they're going to have to make judgment calls. And when those judgment calls are made, and it favors what is wicked rather than what's righteous, it's normalizing and, in fact, exalting what is false, what is a lie against the truth of God. One of the greatest and most egregious things about this turn in our society with respect to homosexual marriage is this very thing. That it's becoming very common to turn people's minds from affirming what is true about the nature of man, so that they begin to affirm at a very fundamental level something which is highly unnatural. They're exalting a lie, and now the lie is a lie that strikes the very nature of the creation. So we've turned away from the Creator, and now you're seeing why Paul says eventually it ends up in societies which are totally perverse and unnatural. It all begins with this attitude. In fact, when we reward the wicked as though it's righteous, it is in fact to decree unrighteous decrees, which Isaiah also complains about in Isaiah 10:1.
Isaiah 10, verse 1. Woe unto them that decree unrighteous decrees, and that write grievousness which they have prescribed.
But secondly, if we consider this commandment and where we fit in judicatories, and again, we can make application beyond these civil and ecclesiastical courts, but as an accuser, we violate this commandment. Not simply by reason of being an accuser, because we're going to see in a little while that sometimes it's necessary to bring things to light in order to keep this command. But if we're functioning as an accuser and we do it by giving a false evidence, we're in violation of this command. Look at Proverbs 6, 16 and 19.
Proverbs 6, verse 16. These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him. And verse 19, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren.
False witness gives false evidence. And in a case where judgment needs to be rendered, you may in fact mislead the judge in human affairs, in civil and ecclesiastical judicatures. But ultimately, if you understand that all that you're doing when you're being called upon, particularly in these situations, you're being asked and really called upon by lawful authority to tell the truth, all of that is being subsumed under an oath or a vow or an assumption that you're doing it before God. And so you're calling him to witness. And that's why it's an abomination to God. You have to remember the Bible is very clear, and we are assured that no one who does this is going to escape punishment, because the judge who ultimately will rectify everything will never be misled by any false evidence or lies that you or I or anyone else could fabricate. Look at Proverbs 19:5.
Proverbs 19, verse 5. A false witness shall not be unpunished, and he that speaketh lies shall not escape.
There's no escape. There is a judgment day, and all things that are done in secret are going to come to light. You know, you may think you got away with something, and to all outward appearances, you might have every reason to be confirmed in that judgment in this life. But this life will come to an end, and if you haven't been seized upon, and if this hasn't been rectified in this life, it will be taken up and rectified at that time when all accounts are settled. There's a reason why in the Christian church we commend to people, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but why we commend confession. We ought to confess our sins to one another. That's a truthful assessment of our untruthful dealing with the truth. Right, the second way as an accuser that we are guilty of this is by suborning or inducing false witnesses. That's, look at Acts 6:13.
Acts 6, verse 13. And set up false witnesses, which said, this man ceaseth not to speak blasphemous words against this holy place and the law.
Yeah, suborning a witness is inducing them, whether by money or some other means, bribing or by whatever means, getting a witness to turn. They're no longer going to tell the truth. We're, as accusers, when we do that, what we're doing is we're not only loading they're stacking the deck against the accused, but we're involving other people now by some sort of force or some sort of some other kind of inducement to violate this law together with us. That's a conspiracy against the truth. Yeah, this is exactly what we see going on, not only in the case of the apostles in Acts, but in the Gospels we see this happening. When they're looking for accusers against Christ, they're trying to get two people to agree. You know, there's a reason why two people can't agree a lot of times, and that is because they're not telling the truth. The truth ought to have some sort of general and even specific point of agreement and alignment. The third way as an accuser is by wittingly appearing and pleading for an evil cause. Look at Jeremiah 9, 3 and 5.
Jeremiah 9. They bend their tongues like their bow for lies, but they are not valiant for the truth upon the earth. They proceed from evil to evil, and they know not me, saith the Lord. Verse 5. And they will deceive everyone his neighbor, and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies, and weary themselves to
Yes, it's really a violation of this command. We're going to engage ourselves to what? To a deliberate attempt to undermine the truth and appear and plead for some evil cause? Well, it's very clearly contrary to the ninth commandment. And it's especially so when it's aggravated by the fact that we're out facing or defying the truth. Look at Acts 24, 2 and 5.
Acts 24, verse 2. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence. Verse 5. We have found this man a pestilent fellow and a mover of a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes.
When we appear for an evil cause, and this word that the Catechism uses, outfacing, that means that we're really defiantly, we don't really care what the truth is, we're simply going to plead the cause, no matter how evil. When that's our attitude, we're just going to sort of bluster through. That's a violation of this command that is even more aggravating. What it shows is, not only are you willing to play fast and loose with the truth, that is, in violation of the ninth commandment, but you don't even care about the truth. All you care about is your cause, no matter how bad it is. So you're going to plow through that. It's also aggravated when our pleading is overbearing the truth. Look at Psalm 12, 3 and 4, and 52, 1 to 4.
Psalm 12, verses 3 and 4. The Lord shall cut off all flattering lips, and the tongue that speaketh proud things. Who have said, with our tongue will we prevail? our lips are our own. Who is the Lord over us?
Psalm 52, 1 through 4. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. Thy tongue deviseth mischief like a sharp razor, working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness, Selah. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue.
The fact is that man is, fallen man, is in love with lying. And in a state of constant war with the truth. So again, if we are engaged in a bad cause, an evil cause, and we don't really care about it, all that we're going to do is we're literally going to outshout the truth. We think that somehow all we have to do is be louder and a bigger presence in the room than the truth, and that somehow is going to overcome the truth. That too shows that there's a fundamental disregard for the ninth commandment. It's an aggravation. But that's what they mean when they're talking about overbearing the truth. That idea, that attitude that some people have, that if they just shout louder, the truth is going to go away. All they have to do is keep shouting their stupid slogan or asserting their false premise, and the truth is going to cower and finally wither away. That just shows that they're in love with their own bad cause. It doesn't show that they love the truth. And that's a violation of this command. Fourth, as accuser by forging or deliberately creating false evidence. We're in violation of this command. Look at Psalm 119, verse 69.
Psalm 119, verse 69. The proud have forged a lie against me, but I will keep thy precepts with my whole heart.
The proud have forged a lie against me. And that's exactly what it is. It's a matter of pride. Men would rather study their own pride than the truth. That's why men forge evidence, create false documents, create false impressions. It's a kind of forgery. It's aggravated, this forgery, whenever it leads to personal gain. Look at Luke 19:8.
Luke 19, verse 8. And Zacchaeus stood and said unto the Lord, Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold.
Yeah, Zacchaeus is concerned about making a proper restitution because he knows that his forgeries, his false accusations, have led to his personal aggrandizement. It's an aggravation of this. It's bad enough when you are forging something just because you want to prosecute your bad cause. It's aggravated when that bad cause that you're trying to support is your own covetousness. Now, we're going to begin talking, Lord willing, next week about covetousness in the 10th commandment, but that presents another level of aggravation here. It's also an aggravation of this forging of false evidence, if in any way it's done to deprive another man of his right. Look at Luke 16, 5 to 7.
Luke 16, verses 5 through 7. He called every one of his Lord's debtors unto him, and said unto the first, How much owest thou unto my Lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said unto him, Take that bill, and sit down quickly, and write 50. Then said he to another, And how much owest thou? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said unto him, Take thy bill and write 80.
Yeah, a lot of people seem to think that this is a good economic principle for getting something rather than nothing. But if we remember that Jesus characterizes this man as the unjust steward, we'll understand why this text appears at this point in the Catechism. What he's doing is not depriving himself by telling them to mark it down. He's depriving the person at the other end who actually had a right. And so he's willing to deal with the truth in a very loose way to preserve and, in fact, secure his own position at the expense of someone else. And if all he has to do is create a little bit of false evidence to go around in order to facilitate that, so be it. It's a violation of the Ninth Commandment. Now, that's not to say that, you know, the person who has the right doesn't have the right to tell him to do something like that, but in this case, we really don't see that being the case. So we need to be very careful about the way we read the Bible. You know, people tend to read things into it that they want to see there rather than what's really going on. You know, the whole point of that is he's wise in the ways of the world. It's not, the whole point of that parable is not that he is a genuinely righteous man. Just in terms of the world, he's going to wow them with his ability to be slick and business savvy and perhaps even have a good grasp on what he needs to do to advance his own personal agenda. The third consideration with regard to these public judicatories, whether we're talking civil or ecclesiastical, is we have to consider how you can violate this command as a defendant. And that's done very often simply by denying the justness of a charge when called to a free confession. Look at Proverbs 28:13 and Jeremiah 2:35.
Proverbs 28:13. He that covereth his sins shall not prosper, but whoso confesseth and forsaketh them shall have mercy.
Jeremiah 2:35. If thou sayest, because I am innocent, surely his anger shall turn from me. Behold, I will plead with thee, because thou sayest, I have not sinned.
If you are called upon by competent authority in your life, in this case we're talking about judicatories, but again, we need to make application beyond this. This commandment requires, in all cases where competent authority is asking, inquiring about the justness of a charge, if you're in a state of denial, and in fact it's a just charge, you're in violation of this. You're simply refusing to own the truth objectively. This is especially aggravated when there are attempts to hide the fact. Look at 2 Kings 5:25 and Genesis 4:9.
2 Kings 5, verse 25, but he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said unto him, whence comest thou, Gehazi? And he said, thy servant went no whither.
Genesis 4, verse 9, and the Lord said unto him, where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper?
Yeah, you don't, you're not helping your grasp of the truth and your regard for the truth when instead of simply denying outright the justness of a charge, you're trying to hide the justness of the charge in some way. You're kind of rolling off the question. You're deflecting. That's what they're trying to do. And it doesn't work. It may work with a human judge, but ultimately it's just going to land you in more trouble. You know, remember, God ultimately is the one who's overseeing the truth. He's the one who's ultimately concerned with the truth. Jesus is very concerned with the truth because he is the way and the truth as well as the life. There's an aggravation of this in the defendant when he tries to excuse the fact. Look at Proverbs 30, verse 20.
Proverbs 30, verse 20. Such is the way of an adulterous woman. She eateth and wipeth her mouth and saith, I have done no wickedness.
Yeah, there's just an entire disregard for the truth. A denial that there was any wrongdoing. That's just an excuse. It's an attempt to walk right through the lie and own it as the truth against the truth. That's what excuses are. An excuse is trying to say, in my situation, for some reason, what in every other situation would have been a lie or would have been against the truth would have been a violation of God's commandments, would have been a chargeable offense. For me, it doesn't count. It's also an aggravation when there's an attempt some way to extenuate the sin. Look at Genesis 3, 12 and 13.
Genesis 3, verses 12 and 13. And the man said, the woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat. And the Lord said unto the woman, what is this that thou hast done? And the woman said, the serpent beguiled me, and I did eat.
Yeah, that's the attitude of a lot of people. Everybody does it. And everybody around me. You weren't there. If you had just been there, you would have too. That's trying to extenuate the sin. We're not called upon to extenuate the justness, or extenuate by way of denying the justness of a charge. If we're the defendants in these cases, we need to own the justness, because the truth is more important than any good that you perceive coming to yourself by adding another lie to your sin. You really want to add breach of the ninth commandment to everything else you've done? Why don't you stop? Why don't you have a little timeout session and a little tete-a-tete with the truth and confess the justness of the charge? If you do, there's forgiveness. If you don't, there's judgment day. And if it doesn't catch up either before then, it will then. All right, the fourth way in these situations that we function in these judicatures potentially is as witnesses, and we can sin against the truth as witnesses in any of these types of cases. First of all, by concealing some truth or by not making a free and full disclosure. Look at Leviticus 5:1 and Deuteronomy 13:8.
Leviticus 5, verse 1. And if a soul sin, you hear the voice of swearing, and is a witness, whether he has seen of it, or whether he has seen or known of it, if he do not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity. Deuteronomy 13, verse 8. Thou shalt not consent unto him, nor hearken unto him, neither shalt thou I pity him, neither shalt thou spare, neither shalt thou conceal him.
Yet, as a witness, you have an obligation. Again, this obligation extends outside of judicatures. There is an added level of seriousness when an express vow is in view. But there's always an implicit, or should be an implicit understanding that when you're called upon to tell the truth, that God is the witness, whether or not you're doing it. if you conceal some truth for whatever reason, in a case where it's going to affect the justice, you are in violation of this truth. You know, people do this all the time. They'll tell you part of the story. They won't tell you the part of the story you need to make an accurate assessment of what happened or what should be done. Very often people want to leave those kinds of things out, sometimes because it would involve a bit of self-incrimination. But you don't have a right to conceal the truth. It is, in fact, a violation of this command. A second, as a witness, if you maintain undue silence in a just cause. Look at Acts 5, 3, 8, and 9, and 2 Timothy 4, 16.
Acts 5, verse 3, Peter said, Ananias, why hath Satan filled thine heart to lie to the Holy Ghost and to keep back the honor of the Christ of the Lamb? And verse 8 and 9, and Peter answered unto her, tell me whether he sold the land for so much. And she said, yea, for so much. Then Peter said unto her, how is it that you agree together to tempt the Spirit of the Lord? Behold, the feet of them which have buried thy husband are at the door, and shall carry thee out.
2 Timothy 4:16. At my first answer, no man stood with me, but all men forsook me. I pray God that it may not be laid to their charge.
Yeah, Paul has to pray God it's not laid to their charge that they, what? That they remained silent in a just cause. And when you see someone else being assaulted, you see an injustice that's being offered in some way, and you know something that could affect the outcome in a proper way, but you're concerned about something other than the truth, you're in violation of this commandment. You stand condemned. You're dealing in a very careless and callous manner with the truth. We're to have regard for the truth in all of our relations. We're to have a very high regard for this truth. And understand that the truth should take precedent, particularly in cases where there are fundamental issues of equity and justice involved. The justness of a cause is call enough for us to step forward when we can, when we have evidence or we have something that we can say on behalf of the truth. Standing back, standing by, and allowing people to pile on their lies against the truth when we know differently makes us complicit in their assault against the truth. Or the fourth way we fail as witnesses is by telling anything that's not true. Proverbs 19:9.
A false witness shall not be unpunished, and he that speaketh lies shall perish.
Yeah, we probably don't need to spend a whole lot of time on this, but it really should be relatively obvious that if we are false witnesses, we're undermining the entire purpose of having witnesses. We're undermining the whole process. You know, we have witnesses, we engage in this process so that at the end of it all, there will be a just or an equitable outcome. There will be some kind of sentence rendered or opinion that is in fact brought forth that exonerates the truth and the party in the contest who's on the side of the truth. If we get in there and we start mixing it up and throwing in lies, what we're doing as witnesses is we're making it harder for there to be justice administered in that case. It's better to say a lot less and say the truth than to say a lot more and start adding things that are just going to complicate the prosecution of the case and arriving at just outcome. All right. Beside all of the ways that we can apply what we've just talked about in our common conversation that is outside of these courts of justice, whether civil or ecclesiastical, we're hindering the truth whenever, first of all, we hold our peace when iniquity calls for some reproof from our lips. Look at 1 Kings 1:6.
1 Kings 1:6. And his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, "Why hast thou done so?" And he also was a very goodly man, and his mother bare him after Absalom.
And what did his father fail to do? He failed to reprove him. And when we fail to do that, when we fail to call out iniquity, especially when it is not only in our power but under our authority to call it out, we are failing with regard to this ninth commandment. Right? It's a kind of hatred of our brother, as a matter of fact, to fail in this regard. Look at Leviticus 19:17.
Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer sin upon him.
Yeah, if we allow this to go on, this iniquity, if we don't call it out when we can, when we should, it's actually a violation of charity. You know, a lot of people think that it's just being unkind or mean or nasty in some way when we reprove people. But reproof is really an evidence of fundamental love for someone else. We don't generally go around reproving people that we either don't know or don't care about, or people who are not really important to us. Very seldom does that happen. We generally save reproof for people that we know, and particularly the more that we care about them, the more freedom we generally feel to use reproof. If, on the other hand, we begin to view that reproof as something negative when it's just reproof, Moses says that we're in violation of a fundamental rule of charity. In fact, Jesus quotes this verse when he says that we're to love our neighbor as ourself. He's quoting the immediate preceding bit of this verse from Leviticus 19. All right, we hinder the truth when we hold our peace, when iniquity calls for us to make a complaint to others. Look at Isaiah 59:4.
Isaiah 59:4. None calleth for justice, nor any pleadeth for truth. They trust in vanity and speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity.
Yep. The fact is that in our common conversation, sometimes we're called upon to make a complaint to others. You know, it is a matter of iniquity in us if we fail to call their iniquity to account, not only to themselves, but in fact, perhaps to others, so that there is an accounting taken. Again, the most important thing is that the truth be maintained, that we're concerned to see that righteousness and justice and equity in society are maintained. And that requires a proper regard for the truth. Now, this command is also violated in our speech itself, in our way of speaking, whenever, first of all, we speak the truth unseasonably or at an inappropriate time. Look at Proverbs 29:11.
Proverbs 29:11. A fool knows all his mind, but a wise man keeps it in until afterwards.
Yeah, it's a mark of a fool to speak everything at all times. We need to speak the truth, but not unseasonably, not at every time, and not necessarily all the truth. You know, sometimes we use the truth, and that's the point of these various points we're going to talk about here. Sometimes we can turn the truth to an end for which it's not appointed, which is why we need to be very careful in these matters. Second, when we speak the truth maliciously to a wrong end, 1 Samuel 22:9-10, and Psalm 52:1-5.
1 Samuel 22:9-10. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, and gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine.
Psalm 52:1-5.
Yeah, read the title there, too.
To the chief musician, Maschil, a psalm of David, when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul, and said unto him, David has come to the house of Ahimelech. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. Thy tongue deviseth mischief like a sharp razor, working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness, Selah. Thou lovest all devouring words with a deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. He shall take thee away and pluck thee out of thy dwelling place and root thee out of the land of the living, Selah.
The fact is that we can speak the truth, but we can speak it in a way which is malicious and to some wrong end. We can speak the truth that in such a way or in such an occasion as to bring harm to others. That's a misuse of speaking of the truth. Our concern for the truth is not divorced from everything else. Remember, there are 9 other commandments around this commandment. And that's one of the tricks, if you will, about understanding and applying these commandments, understanding the limitations and the context. And we don't have a right to speak the truth if it's going to bring about, for example, the unjust punishment or death of another. Unless there is something about the truth and that moment that would in some way trump that. Like, it would be a matter of if you didn't do it, you would be denying the faith. Remember, speaking the truth doesn't mean you have to speak it all the time and everywhere. You have a right to hold your peace, too. Just not when truth and or justice and equity are involved. We can violate this when we speak the truth to pervert it to a wrong meaning. Look at Psalm 56:5.
Every day they rest my words, all their thoughts are against me for evil.
Every day they rest my words. If we take true words and twist them to mean something else, we're violating the truth. We're violating this command. To take the words of another which are in and of themselves true, and to apply them to a wrong end is a violation of this command. And it's an aggravation of it when it's all done for a bad cause, by the way. Right? This is especially true if we take true words and twist them uncharitably to the harm of another. Look at John 2:19, and we want to compare that with Matthew 26:16-61.
John 2:19. Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up.
Matthew 26:60-61. But found none, yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. At the last came two false witnesses, and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.
Yeah, the fact is that men took those words Jesus spoke, and they twist them. They don't simply twist them, but they're twisting them knowing that they're bringing about his harm. That's a misuse of the truth. And it's an aggravation of that. Right? We're violating this in our speech when we speak using doubtful or equivocal expressions, whereby the truth is prejudiced often to the loss of justice. Look at Genesis 3:5 and 26:7-9.
Genesis 3:5, for God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. Genesis 26:7.
And the men of the place asked him of his wife, and he said, she is my sister, for he feared to say, she is my wife, lest, said he, the men of the place should kill me for Rebekah, because she was fair to look upon. And verse 9. And Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, of a surety she is thy wife. Now sayest thou, she is my sister. And Isaac said unto him, because I said, lest I die for her.
When we speak equivocally, though it is the truth, if our intention is to somehow deceive, we're violating this commandment. You know, in the garden, if the serpent had said, yeah, in that day that you eat thereof, your eyes will be open, you'll know the difference, you'll know, or you'll judge between good and evil. And, oh, by the way, if God is merciful and intervene, you're going to be on your way to hell. He sort of cut off that ending, which would have made it clear. You know, the equivocal part stayed. And that's really what equivocating is. And to say, she's my sister, well, in Semitic terms, yes, she is. But she is my wife, leaving that part off, is creating a situation where some very serious violations of other commands can come into play. It could have been prevented simply by speaking the truth. This is a case where he put fear of man before fear of God and the telling of the truth. Right? It's also a case that we violate when we speak using untruth. Look at Isaiah 59:13.
Isaiah 59:13. In transgressing and lying against the Lord and departing away from our God, speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart words of falsehood.
In words of falsehood. That's not the same as outright lying. Words of falsehood, and I think what they're and why they distinguish here between untruth and lying is words of falsehood are words which are constructed, leading words that maybe in and of themselves are not lies, But together, when they're put in that kind of context, it creates an untruth. What they're talking about is that idea of giving a false impression. You know, when you construct something or say something in such a way as to give a false impression, that's distinguished from, but also as much a sin as outright lying. Look at Leviticus 19:11 and Colossians 3:9.
Leviticus 19:11. You shall not steal, neither deal falsely, neither lie one to another.
Colossians 3:9. Why not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds?
The sixth way that we violate this command in our speech is when we speak either too highly, or think too highly, or too meanly or lowly of ourselves or of others. There are a lot of examples of this that they give. Luke 18:9 and 11, Romans 12:16, 1 Corinthians 4:6, Acts 12:22, and Exodus 4:10-14.
Luke 18:9-11. And he spake this parable of a certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. And Luke 11, the Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself: God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican.
Romans 12:16. Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceit.
1 Corinthians 4:6. And these things, brethren, I have in a figure transferred to myself and to Apollos for your sakes, that ye might learn in us not to think of men above that which is written, that no one of you be puffed up for one against another.
Acts 12:22. And the people gave a shout, saying, it is the voice of a god and not of a man.
Exodus 4:10-14. And Moses said unto the Lord, O my Lord, am I not eloquent, neither heretofore, nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant? But I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. And the Lord said unto him, Who hath made man's mouth, or who maketh the dumb, or deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with thy mouth, and teach thee what thou shalt say. And he said, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he said, Is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well. And also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee, and when he seeth thee, he will be glad in his heart.
The fact is that when we have either too high or too low an opinion of ourselves or of others, we're not really dealing with the truth. We're dealing in something other than the truth. And whether it's in defect, that is, having too low an opinion, or in excess, having too high an opinion, as we're going to see in the next couple of questions, they each cause their own problem. All right, question 3 then. Where do we show ourselves prejudicial to our neighbor's good name? Well, we show ourselves prejudicial when we're not careful to avoid all that is injurious to our neighbor or his good name. First of all, when our words are used uncharitably against the seeking of justice by slandering, number one. We're raising false charges to the damage of his reputation. Look at Psalm 50:20.
Psalm 50:20. Thou citizen speakest against thy brother, thou slanderest thine own mother's son.
If we're raising false charges to damage the reputation, it's slander. We're definitely assaulting our neighbor. Number two, backbiting. That, in fact, is just a form of slander, which is a little bit more aggravated because it presumes the person is absent. Look at Psalm 15:3.
Psalm 15:3. He that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his neighbor, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor.
Third, when we engage in talebearing. Talebearing is gossip, but it's gossip with this added edge. There's usually some kind of a malicious intention. Look at Leviticus 19:16.
Thou shalt not go up and down as a talebearer among thy people, neither shalt thou stand against the blood of thy neighbor unto the Lord.
That's fourth, when we engage in whispering. Whispering, by whispering they mean secret or surreptitious expression of some belief or rumor, usually of scandal. Look at Romans 1:19-20.
Romans 1:19-20. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even in his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse.
The fact is that, again, that actually that should be Romans 1:29-30. Excuse me.
Romans 1:29-30, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents.
Right. So, whispering is that chattering that goes on behind the scenes when people are sort of quietly passing on the rumor mill. And usually, as I say, there's some kind of scandal that is either implied or involved in what is being said. That's why it's secret or surreptitious. Notice that surreptitious has a secret syllable in it, if you're wondering how to remember what that word means. Right, fifth, when they're scoffing, which is, in fact, speaking to someone in a derisive or a mocking manner. Look at Genesis 21:9.
Genesis 21:9. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking.
And that, in fact, scoffing is, or mocking is, accounted a form of persecution. Look at Galatians 4:29.
Galatians 4:29. But as then he was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the spirit, even so it is now.
And the sixth way that we do this with our words is when we revile. There's a reviling, which is in fact criticizing in an abusive or angrily insulting manner. Look at 1 Corinthians 6:10.
1 Corinthians 6:10, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners shall inherit the kingdom of God.
It's a violation of the ninth commandment. Why? Because in all of these cases, what is motivating the words that are being used is not a concern for the truth. It's rather a venting of passions. Second, we can say that we violate and in fact, exercise something, show ourselves prejudicial to our neighbor's good name, when through pride or self-conceit of heart, we are rash. Rashness consists in an uncharitable judging and condemning of others in our hearts. Look at Matthew 7:1.
Matthew 7:1. Judge not, that you be not judged.
Yeah, Jesus isn't talking about judging, not judging righteous judgment. He's talking about rash judgment. He's talking about that kind of judgment that we see very often in people, this propensity in people to make instantaneous judgments that are uncharitable. That's what he's condemning here. He's not saying don't judge according to the word of God, but in fact judge according to righteous judgment. Don't judge, don't make a judgment that's not based in reality, that actually is flowing from some uncharitable construction. Right? Second, we violate this when we are harsh or possessed of cruel judgments without warrant. Look at Acts 28:4.
Acts 28:4. And when the barbarians saw the venomous beast hang on his hand, they said among themselves, no doubt this man is a murderer, whom, though he hath escaped the sea, yet vengeance suffereth not to live.
Yeah, vengeance suffereth not to live. Where do they come to, how do they come to that conclusion? It is, in fact, the cornerstone of paganism to judge everything in terms of providence rather than the word of God. And people who base their judgments in that way tend to be harsh because they're not seeing anything but the outward reality. They're not studying or considering the inward reality. That's why they come to this conclusion. They see a serpent latch onto Paul's hand. Oh, he must be a horrible person that vengeance isn't going to suffer to live. You know, he must have done something bad and he somehow got here, but now karma's going to get him. All right, third, we violate when we engage in a partial censuring, which is this. It's partial when we allow in ourselves what we condemn in others. Look at Genesis 38:24 and Romans 2:1.
Genesis 38:24. And it came to pass about 3 months after that it was told Judas and Tamar, the daughter-in-law, and played the harlot. And also, behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judas said, bring her forth, and let her be burnt.
Romans 2:1. Therefore thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest. For wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest doest the same things.
And what is the problem with Judah? Well, he's going to burn Tamar for doing exactly what he did. That's partiality in our censuring. And if we're going to condemn something in others, we need to be equally willing to condemn it in ourselves. And in fact, we should. You know, it's an error of modernity and modern judgment to put aside or think that we should put aside righteous judgment and engage in that kind of partiality that we're only going to judge what others are doing. We need to judge ourselves, and we shouldn't suspend all judgment. We really need to deal with the truth, the same with regard to ourselves as others. That's, at the end of it all, what's in view. All right, fourth, we're in violation of this, and it again is a matter of pride and self-conceit of heart, when we misconstruct intentions. Look at Nehemiah 6:6-8.
Nehemiah 6:6-8. Wherein was written, it is recorded among the heathen, and Gashmu said that thou and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king according to these words. And thou hast also appointed prophets to preach unto thee at Jerusalem, saying, there is a king in Judah, and now shall it be reported unto the king according to these words. Come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. And I sent unto him, saying, there are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them out of thine own heart.
Right, when we misconstruct words, look at Romans 3:8.
Romans 3:8. And not rather, as we these letters they reported, and as some of them that we say, let us do evil that good may come, since their nation is just.
All when there's a misconstructing of actions.
Psalm 69, verse 10. When I wept and chastened my soul with fasting, that was to my reproach.
1 Samuel 1, verses 13 through 15. Now Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard, therefore Eli thought she had been drunken. And Eli said unto her, How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from me. And Hannah answered and said, No, my lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord.
2 Samuel 10, verse 3. And the princes of the children of Ammon said unto Hanan their lord, Thinkest thou that David doth honor thy father, that he hath sent comforters unto thee? Hath not David rather sent his servants unto thee to take the city, to spy it out, and to overthrow it?
Yep. All of these have in common, whether we're misconstructing intents, words, or actions, a fundamental lack of charity, heart charity, toward others. And that is trumping truth. Your attitude, your demeanor toward others is in fact causing you to put aside a fair dealing with the truth. It's a violation of this command. All right, fifth, having unjust suspicions of him. 1 Timothy 6:4.
1 Timothy 6, verse 4. He is proud, knowing nothing, but doting about questions and strifes of words, whereof cometh envy, strife, railings, evil surmises.
And that's all contrary to the charity that we're commanded to have toward one another. Look at 1 Corinthians 13:7.
1 Corinthians 13, verse 7. Beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things.
Why is it we have these unjust suspicions? Why is it we're filled with this trepidation with regard to other people? Usually it's fundamental lack of charity. We're exalting our own lack of charity over a concern for the truth. And we're allowing that to control our judgment. That's contrary to this command. Our judgment ought to be commanded by the truth and not by our passions or our distempers. Right? Sixth, when we envy or grieve at the deserved credit or esteem of any man. Look at Numbers 11:29 and Matthew 21:15.
Numbers 11:29. And Moses said unto him, Enviest thou for my sake? Would God that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put in his spirit upon them?
Matthew 21:15. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good?
And that's especially the case if this envy or grief is accompanied with an endeavor or desire to impair the credit or esteem of another. Look at Ezra 4:12-13.
Ezra 4:12-13. Be it known unto the king that the Jews which came up from thee to us are come unto Jerusalem, building a rebellious and bad city, and have set up the walls thereof and joined the foundations. Be it known now unto the king that if the city be builded and the walls set up again, then will they not pay toll, tribute, and custom? So thou shalt
endanger
the revenue of the kings.
Right. And seventh, when we rejoice in the disgrace or infamy of others. Jeremiah 48:27.
Jeremiah 48:27.
But was not Israel infamy? Was he found among thieves? For since thou spakest of him, thou skippest for joy. Yeah, the fact... There again, what is Jeremiah pointing to? He's pointing to this idea that people, it's untoward to rejoice in the disgrace or infamy of others. Again, this is all a matter of flowing from a fundamental lack of charity. There's a self-conceit. There's pride of heart involved. These are all contrary to the ninth commandment because they're not flowing from a concern for the truth. They're flowing from personal passions and distempers. All right, third, we went through carelessness or malice. We, first of all, unnecessarily discover the faults and infirmities of others. Genesis 9:22.
And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren about.
We're not... we need to be careful about the truth. And we don't... We're not excused with regard to our concern for the truth just because we've been careless. If our carelessness involves an unnecessary discovering of faults and infirmities of others, especially in superiors, when inferiors do that to superiors, it is a great aggravation and an attack on the truth. You know, it's not a matter of simply telling the truth. Remember, there is in the telling of the truth, it ought to be joined with a concern that justice and equity are done by the truth. And this serves no purpose. We're talking about it's unnecessary. We violate when through carelessness or malice we aggravate their lesser faults, whereby we often seek to extenuate our own faults. Matthew 7, verses 3 through 5.
And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, Let me pull out the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye.
The third way that we violate is when we revive the memory of our neighbor's crimes, which were worn out of mind, especially being repented of. Look at 2 Samuel 16:7-8.
2 Samuel 16:7-8. And thus said Shimei, when he had cursed, come out, thou bloody man, and thou man of Belial. The Lord hath returned upon thee all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned. And the Lord hath delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom thy son. And behold, thou art taken in thy mischief, because thou art a bloody man.
Yeah, what is Shimei doing? He's reviving this memory. To what purpose and end? Is it true? Yes, it's true. To what end? To undermine David's fundamental authority. It's a violation of the ninth commandment. Again, remember, this command has to be joined with a sincere desire to see that there is justice or equity at the end of the telling of the truth. Right, fourth, when through our carelessness or malice we betray secrets committed to us. Proverbs 17:9.
He that covereth a transgression seeketh love. He that repeateth a matter separateth very friends.
Yeah, and that is accounted, in fact, traitorous behavior. 2 Timothy 3:4.
2 Timothy 3:4. Right here. Traitors, petty, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God.
Fifth, whenever through our carelessness or malice we detract or in some other way endeavor to impair the credit of our neighbor. Look at Jeremiah 38:4.
Jeremiah 38:4. Therefore the prince has said unto the king, We beseech thee, let this man be put to death, for thus he weakeneth the hands of the men of war that remain in the city, and the hands of all the people, in speaking such words unto them. For this man seeketh not the welfare of the people, but the hurt.
Yeah, those people who do that, people who detract or try to impair the credit of their neighbors, are accounted judges of the law. If we look at James 4:11.
Speak not evil one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother, speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. But if thou judge the law, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge.
Yeah, why do we say that? Why does James say that? That you're a judge of the law when you do this? Because again, what you're doing is you're using the truth without any concern that real justice be done. In other words, you're using the truth as a pretext for violating the Ninth Commandment. Because the Ninth Commandment is about an outcome that involves truth, that is justice, equity. But if you're going to detract, use something true to impair the credit of another, you, in fact, have set yourself up as a judge of the law. Because you are going to set the law against the intent of the law. And that makes you something more than under the law. That makes you assume a position over the law. You're a judge. You become a judge. And not simply a judge in a matter, but a judge over the law itself. And that is an egregious violation of this commandment. All right, 6, when you raise false rumors to the prejudice of our neighbor, if we look at Exodus 23:1.
Exodus 23:1, thou shalt not raise a false report, put not thine hand to the wicked to be an unrighteous witness.
Or if we receive and countenance such evil reports, Proverbs 29:12.
Proverbs 29:12, if a ruler hearken to lies, all his servants are wicked.
And in the seventh place, if we stop our ears against a just defense. Look at Acts 7:56-57 and Job 31:13-14.
Acts 7:56-57, and said, behold, I see the heavens open, and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God. And they cried out with a loud voice and stopped their ears and ran upon him with one accord.
Job 31:13-14. If I despise the cause of my manservant or of my maidservant when they contended with me, what then shall I do when God riseth up and when he visiteth? What shall I answer him?
You know, the fact is, again, what you're doing in all of these cases is you're separating in this commandment the concern for the truth objectively from the concern for the truth relationally. You're saying that the truth can somehow defeat the truth, and that there is that it is in fact it doesn't matter, as long as it is truth objectively, it doesn't matter whether or not that truth is going to be used actively, passively, in a way that conduces to the end for which truth is appointed, which is justice and equity, common honesty among societies of men. When you stop your ears to the truth, what you're doing is sort of the reverse of that. You've already taken in a judgment. That is, you've already concluded something to be true apart from the truth. You separated the objective and the relational. There needs to be care taken then that we do not sin in defect by holding others in scornful contempt. Look at Psalm 35:15-16-21. In Matthew 27:28-29.
Psalm 35:15-16. But in mine adversity they rejoiced and gathered themselves together. Yea, the abjects gathered themselves together against me, and I knew it not. They did tear me and cease not. With hypocritical mockers and feasts, they gnashed upon me with their teeth. And verse 21, yea, they opened their mouth wide against me and said, aha, aha, our eye hath seen it.
Matthew 27, verses 28 and 29, they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. And when they had plaited a crown of thorns, and they put it upon his head, and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him, and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews.
The fact is that holding others in scornful contempt is often pretext for joining sin to sin by our vainglorious boasting. Look at 2 Timothy 3:2.
2 Timothy 3, verse 2. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy.
Yeah, this is a sinning in defect. Right? We're thinking too lowly of others and too highly of ourselves. On the other hand, we have to be very careful that we don't sin in excess by holding men's persons in fond admiration. Look at Jude 16 and X 12:22 again.
Verse 16, these are murmurers, complainers, walking after their own lusts, and their mouths speaketh great swelling words, having men's persons in admiration because of the banished.
Yeah, there's, in this case, it's often accompanied with another breach of the command, which is flattery. Look at Psalm 12, 2 and 3.
Psalm 12.
X 12. Go ahead and do X 12:22.
And the people gave a shout, saying, "It is the voice of a god and not of a man."
Right. That's holding people in fond admiration. You're elevating them in your mind beyond where it ought to be, and it often leads to flattery. Psalm 12:2-3.
They speak vanity, every one with his neighbor. With flattering lips and with a double heart do they speak. The Lord shall cut off all flattering lips and the tongue that speaketh proud things.
In this second case, where we sin in excess, what we're doing here is almost exactly the opposite. We tend to have too high an opinion of others, and we join it with too low an opinion of ourselves. In both cases, the result is flowing from the fact that we're not dealing in truth. We're dealing in perception. We're dealing in image. We're dealing in something other than the truth. And we're allowing it to affect our judgment. We're allowing it to affect how we interact with one another. It's simply not a matter of common honesty in a society where we have the one and the other. And usually the fact is, in societies which are this out of balance, as you move from person to person and relation to relation, you see this very dynamic in play. All right, the last question we want to deal with here is, wherein do we show ourselves prejudicial to our own good name? Well, besides all the ways that we prejudice our good name, generally, in our carelessness for the truth and our neighbor's good name, we especially do so when by our words we, first of all, bear witness against ourselves unnecessarily and without a due call, discovering our own secret faults and infirmities, especially to those who have no sense of piety. Look at Proverbs 25, 9 and 10.
Proverbs 25, verses 9 and 10. Debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself, and discover not a secret to another, lest he that heareth it put thee to shame, and thine infamy turn not away.
We're to be very, very careful that we don't bear witness against ourselves unnecessarily in general, but especially when we're dealing with unbelievers. You know, the fact is that when we do that unnecessarily, when we discover ourselves to them in our infirmities, we end up harming our own good name before them. And their perception will forever be changed. Right, second, when we bear false witness against ourselves by denying the gifts and graces of God in us. Look at Job 27, 5 and 6, and Job 4, 6.
Job 27, verses 5 and 6. God forbid that I should judge until I die. I will not remove mine integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me so long as I live.
Job 4, verse 6. Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and the uprightness of thy ways?
The fact is, again, that although we're to be modest and humble, we're not to be untruthful in that. That is to say, we should have an accurate and sober assessment of gifts and graces. You know, we shouldn't be denying them to other people. It's not real modesty when you deny something about yourself which is obvious to all in terms of gift or grace. That's affected modesty. It's not real modesty. And that's contrary to this command. Because what you're doing when you affect that is you're really undermining the ninth commandment. You're not telling the truth. You're not dealing accurately with what you and everyone else knows to be the truth. You're showing a disregard for the truth. And it's prejudicial to your own good name because, in fact, what you're doing is you're making yourself into a liar in order to be affectedly modest. A third, we prejudice our own good name when we bear false witness for ourselves. So again, look at Proverbs 28:13.
Proverbs 28:13. Take his garment that is surety for a stranger, and take a pledge of him for a strange woman. 28:13. He that covereth his sins shall not prosper, but whoso confesseth and forsaketh them shall have mercy.
We're called to bear witness to the truth. If we lie, even for ourselves, all that we're doing is we're adding to the list of offenses another reproach to our own character, our own name. It's better, and I've said this before, it's better to be a repentant, honest sinner than it is to be a lying, unrepentant sinner. Honesty is going to win out. Likewise, we do things prejudicial to our own good name by our actions. We do this when we breach any lawful promises. Look at Romans 1:31 and 2 Timothy 3:3.
Romans 1, verse 31. Without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful. 2 Timothy 3, verse 3. Without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are pure.
It's lawful promises are meant to be kept. Now, don't be a covenant breaker. Don't be a truce breaker. When you do, by your actions, you are undermining the ninth commandment. Now, in terms of covenant and truth, truces, very often you're also undermining, explicitly undermining, the third commandment. But you're really trying to undermine the truth of the matter. You're saying that this is not really what happened. This is not the real agreement. Second, we do it with our actions when we neglect such things as are of good report. 1 Samuel 2:24.
1 Samuel 2:24. Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear, you make the Lord's people to transgress.
Yeah, we need to study to do such things as are of good report. Our actions should be such that people who take note of them are coming to good conclusions. That the report that's going to arise from our actions will lead to good reports, not evil reports. You don't want your even lawful behavior, which is, it may be lawful in and of itself, but it's behavior which is playing at the edge of society, or in other words, engaged in any way in something which is unseemly. You don't want that to be getting turned into reports that are going out about you. Right, third, when by our actions we practice or we do not avoid ourselves nor hinder what we can in others, things which procure an ill name. Look at 2 Samuel 13:12-13.
He answered him, "Nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not thou this folly. Thy whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, speak unto the king, for he will not withhold me from thee."
Yeah, we need to be very, very careful. And remember that our actions are going to have an impact on our reputation. And that one ill action can put an opprobrium on our reputation, which is very hard to wipe away. And that as a result of that, the truth is ultimately what's going to be harmed by that. Because the truth may be that action doesn't represent you, but it's going to overshadow you at least for a time. And that's why we need to be careful in this regard. And again, not only with respect to ourselves, but with respect to others. Next time, we want to begin looking at the 10th commandment and what that means in general.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket.
The Puritan hard drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan hard drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan hard drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan hard drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.